Tonight I'd like to talk about some of the things that we've been doing with Solaris Networking. I'd like to start out with a talk about IP filter, given that that's something that's made me almost famous. Talk about packet filtering hooks, which is a project we did to make IP filter work better in Solaris. Stack instances or IP instances, Crossbow, and finally I'd like to finish up with Nemo. For IP filter, we're going to have to take a look at its history, what platforms it runs on, an overview of its design, how we use it, and what it means for using IP filter in Solaris today. IP filter has been around for almost longer than I like to say. First came about in the early 90s when I was working as a systems administrator at the University of Melbourne in Australia. Like many universities, our problem was we didn't have a lot of money to buy computers or fancy equipment. So if we wanted to be on the internet, we had the choice of being on the internet and insecure or not being on the internet. So for a while we were not on the internet, and then I started to work on IP filter so that we could have some security when we were on the internet. At first it started out pretty simple, being able to put in some filtering rules. Later I added in logging so that you could actually record bad packets that were coming into the network. Sometime later I added stateful filtering. In the second half of 2003, I was contracted to Sun in California to help them integrate IP filter into Solaris, or what was then the Solaris 10 equivalent of Nevada. In 2002 was the last major feature addition, and that was the inclusion of address pools, so that you could write a single rule for filtering that referred to a pool rather than having to list a number of different rules for each different IP address. Where does IP filter run? Today it runs pretty much on every Unix operating system. Late last year, I was contacted by somebody from IBM who said that they now had IP filter working on AIX 5.3 ML05, whatever that is. It works on all of the BSDs, FreeBSD, NetBSD, OpenBSD. If you download FreeBSD and NetBSD today, it will be part of those platforms. You might also find it in other small platforms such as Dragonfly BSD or My Homebrew BSD. It can also be made to work on older versions of BSD, such as BSDOX. You can download IP filter for HPOX 11 and run it there. That version of IP filter is actually provided by HP themselves on their own website. IP filter works for IRIC 6.2 and 6.5. At various points in time, I unpacked my IRIX box from storage, booted up, and just checked to see if it's working. IP filter also works with Linux kernels versions 2.4 and 2.6 using the NetFilter framework. Building IP filter on Linux machines can sometimes be a challenge because every Linux distribution is just a little bit different, with different header files and different source files in the kernel tree. Then you have different tools in user space which make it hard to write one script which works well on every platform. but personally, I've had it running on Suzy as well as Red Hat Fedora. And other people have managed to get it working on other versions of Linux. If you're using a real-time operating system, you can find a version of IPFilter to download and use with QNX version 6. And as I suppose all of us here know, IPFilter runs on Solaris and has been for probably around 10 years now. The place where IPFilter started out was on Sunos 4.1 back in the early 90s. And still today, I'll boot up a machine and make sure that it still compiles and works on Sunos 4, even though it's no longer quite as critical. For people who use DEX Alpha machines and maybe Itaniums, you can use IPFilter on the True64 platform, also known as OSF/1. So, in brief, if it's Unix, it probably can or does run IPFilter. The design for IPFilter I tried to keep the design as simple as possible. Firewalling of packets or checking packets against access control lists is done closest to the kernel, so that if you're redirecting packets coming in, you have to filter on the new IP address, not the original IP address on the wire. But on the other hand, if you're doing translation going out, then you filter on the original IP addresses. Between the firewalling and the address translation, it's possible to set up filter rules to do packet accounting if you want to see how many bytes and packets are going in and out your network for each particular host. On the side there, there's a part of IPFilter which interfaces with user space to allow logging to happen. The logging is facilitated by just keeping some data copied in, some data copied from packets in memory, and supplying some read functions for the IP filter devices, so that the IP mon program can then read the log records directly out of the IP filter kernel module. So how do we use IPFilter? There are a collection of utilities. Each one has its own dedicated purpose. To manage the filtering rules for IPFilter, we use the command called IPF. This is responsible for loading in a configuration file from disk space or through pipes or whatever, and updating kernel data structures via ioctls. It's also used for flushing the state tables, flushing out filtering rules, as well as retrieving accounting information and zeroing out accounting rules, etc. For managing the network address translation, the network address translation part of IPFilter, we use a command called ipnat. It's only responsible for the network address translation part of IPFilter. It'll parse and load in the ipnat.conf file. It'll list what NAT rules and active NAT sessions are currently in IPFilter in the kernel, and will report network address translation statistics. If you want to use transparent proxying with IPFilter, you do this in conjunction with IPNAT redirection rules. There are a collection of small kernel proxies for things like FTP, RCommand, NetBIOS, IKE. And IPsec and PPTP. The idea of these is to manage both sessions when you have a command channel as well as a data channel. For logging, we use a program called IPMon. This reads log data records from the IP filter kernel module and then either writes them out to a file, including standard out, or sends them off to syslog, whichever you prefer. And finally, if we want to manage the address pools, we use a command called ipool. It has its own configuration file, which is generally called ipool.conf. IP filter on Solaris. Prior to the version of IP filter you find in Solaris Tay, in Solaris today, that being version 4.1, IP filter used some dirty tricks to get access to all of the packets that were going in and out of IP. And it's important to note that those tricks today wouldn't work with Solaris 10. In versions 3.x, IP filter would overwrite pointers for functions to call an IP for things like IP output, and down in the devices, it'd overwrite all of the WPUT functions, so that when IP was calling a device driver's WPUT to send out a packet, it'd call IP filter instead. And similarly, when a device driver wanted to call IP output to send a packet up into IP, it'd call IP filter, and the packet would be filtered in this manner. The nice thing about that was that there was no configuration required to say, I want filtering on this interface, or having to worry about changing any configuration files when you added a new network interface. When I went to IP filter 4, IP filter was changed to use a streams module called pfil. This required some extra configuration in Solaris, usually done with a command called auto push. So once, when a system booted, the IP filter startup script would execute, and the pfil startup script would execute first, actually, and it would run this command called auto push. And auto push would say, for all the E1000Gs, HMEs, BGEs, etc., I'm going to push this module called pfil on when anyone tries to open it. Now, the catch here was that if you added a new type network card to your system and didn't update this file, then there would be no packet filtering on this network interface, and nothing would tell you that that was the way it was. The advantage of this versus the previous approach was that it played nicely with Solaris, and it generally resulted in fewer crashes because IP filter wasn't using any private interfaces inside the Solaris kernel. For integration into Solaris 10, we needed to make some additional changes on top of this. The pfil module, because integrating source code into Solaris has rules imposed by various architectural committees, we weren't able to import it as it was, where IP filter would just go and ask IP, how do I get to this IP address? What we did with the pfil module was create a new daemon called pfilD, and this would get information out of IP via the routing socket, as well as other system calls, and send that information back into the pfil module. And then IP filter would ask the pfil module about how do I reach an IP address, or what is the IP address for a network interface, etc. The end to that madness came with Build 52 in OpenSolaris, when we put back the packet filtering hooks API. Which leads me on to the packet filtering hooks project. So, I'm just going to recap over the streams approach. And after that, I'm going to discuss some of the performance issues that came with that. What we do with the packet filtering hooks and interactions with zones, what some of the goals were for this project, look at the packet filtering hooks, the API, and some future work. So as I've just mentioned, if you're packet filtering using streams, what you needed to do was just arrange for a streams module to be between the network device driver and IP. There are two mechanisms to achieve this in Solaris today. One is using auto push, and the other is using ifconfig mod insert. Of the two mechanisms, the only one that you're likely to find anyone talking about as being good is auto push. If you're using ifconfig mod insert, there are some additional problems that you might not first be aware of. One of these is that when you insert a new streams module into a stream that has already been open, you know the stream itself isn't closed and reopened, so that if there has been any communication between, say, IP and a device driver before you do your mod insert, you won't see that conversation. What that means for Solaris today is that IP and a device driver can negotiate a feature such as fast pathing or hardware checksums or some other type of thing. And when you come to do your mod insert, you don't know whether or not the module, you don't know if IP and the device driver are actually talking about, are exchanging messages in that way, or they're exchanging messages in the old way, or what the case is. Although this mod insert feature exists, it's actively discouraged. An advantage of using the streams approach is that you can snoop on the entire conversation between IP and a network device driver. So you see things like setting the interface name, turning on and off features, flow control, etc. The downside of this is that it requires a lot of code to support, because when you receive a message up from a device driver, if you want to do IP filtering on it, you've got to now do all your sanity checks for a packet to make sure that there's at least a complete packet there, all the checksums are right, etc. There's a large amount of duplicated effort required on the behalf of the streams module that's between IP and the device driver. And as I mentioned earlier, there's no supported method to access IP's internal data. So there's no way to ask, officially there's no way to say or ask IP, what interface do I use if I want to send a packet out to address X, or does interface Y actually exist? So there's some problems there, and perhaps only one benefit, but the benefit isn't really important to us. In terms of performance, what ended up happening with a streams module being pushed between IP and a device driver was that all of the optimizations that we've been putting into Solaris networking at this layer have been turned off. The reason for this is that IP asks the module directly under it if it supports feature X, and if it doesn't get the right reply, then that feature is automatically turned off. It doesn't send a message in such a way that the module below it should ever pass it on. So things like hardware checksumming, large segments, multi-data transmission, all of these things were turned off once you have a module between IP and the device driver. Now, the end result of having all of these disabled is a 20 to 30% degradation in networking performance, depending on your benchmark when tested on an end host. This is not a good position to be in. Now, by going through with this project and being able to eliminate the Streams module, we've been able to eliminate 90% or more of that performance bump from enabling IP filter. So there's been a lot of benefit to doing this work. At the outset of the project, the goals were fairly simple. We wanted to get packet filtering happening between zones. We wanted to eliminate the performance problems we've just discussed, and we wanted to provide an interface to networking functionality and data supported by the protocols in Solaris today. Packet filtering and zones has been a hot topic ever since zones came out. Even up to the latest Solaris 10 update, it isn't possible to filter packets between zones. And the reason for this is that all interzone and intrazone IP traffic, is just a series of function calls. There's no actual packets being put on or going out or coming in from device drivers. To imitate packets being sent in and out, we had to put hooks inside IP's local delivery of packets. Now, the catch here is that in filtering packets flowing between and inside zones, we end up filtering all loopback traffic. This is significant because prior to doing this, all traffic on LO0 has not been filtered on Solaris. So that if you were to take your IP filter configuration file and enable packet filtering for zones, you could, if you're not careful, disable some critical functionality in Solaris because loopback traffic is prevented from happening. The fake packets, I suppose you might want to call them, that transit inside the kernel are associated with the physical interface that owns the logical interface. To translate that, if you have a BGU0 column 1 in your zone, then packets going in and out of it will be seen to be on a BGU0 interface. If you're doing or writing packet filtering rules that you want to apply to zones, then you need to do all your filtering based on addresses. It's not currently possible to use zone names anywhere in a filtering rule. And last but not least, all the packet filtering is handled by the global zone itself. It's not possible, at least with this project, to manage packet filtering from inside a zone. Which interception points did we add for the packet filtering hooks project? We added hooks for physical out, physical in, and these represent packets going between IP and a network device driver. whether the device driver is a physical piece of hardware, such as a HME card or BGU card, or it's actually software, such as a tunnel device driver or a PPP device driver. Loopback out and in and out, loopback traffic or local host traffic, and all the zones traffic, whether it be intra-zone or inter-zone traffic. And last but not least, there's a forwarding interception point if you're just interested in picking up packets which are going through the machine. Now, along with these these filtering hooks, we added in an API to provide access to data and functionality held within IP. Currently, the API that we've developed is visible in OpenSolaris, but unfortunately, it's currently considered a private interface, which makes it Solaris terminology is what we call unstable. Unstable meaning that it's likely to change from in the near future. This doesn't mean that you can't use it. I'd like to hear from people who would like to use it, and if you're using OpenSolaris, you should feel free to use it, make changes to it, and provide feedback or comments. Private and unstable doesn't mean you can't hack it in OpenSolaris. It just means buyer beware if you're building a commercial application to run on Solaris 10. Some of the networking data structures and functions that we needed to provide access to are things like the resolving an interface name. Does BGE0 exist? Does a HME0 exist, etc.? We wanted to know, does a network interface exist? And we want an identifier of some sort to match up with that. And we also need to be able to find out what sort of address information is associated with that network interface. So use this API to find out what the broadcast address is, what the network address is, or just what IP address is assigned to it. And if you've got, and you can also walk through all of the logical interfaces associated with a network interface if you want to know what they are. Now, it's not just enough to know what an network interface's address is at any point in time. You also need to know if that address changes, so you don't need to keep polling every half a second or whatever. So there are callbacks that let you know when an interface is plumbed, when an interface is unplumbed, or network address changes. So what are the things we're looking to do with this in the future? The first thing that we need to look at is allowing multiple hooks to actually modify packet data. Our first attempt at supporting this was to say different hooks have a different priority, but this was rejected during architectural review, and we were advised that we needed to limit it to just a single call out if we were modifying data. Other things we'd like to be able to do would be to support filtering at other layers, such as filtering at the MAC layer, or maybe even up in TCP. There's some demand for adding in more interception points for IP packets. The two most obvious ones are for local in and local out, which are present on Linux today. How these differ from the others is that packets seen on local out are those that are being transmitted by an application and will eventually be seen on physical out. Similarly, local in is for packets that are destined for an application and have come from an external device. Now, if you'd like to discuss this project or have ideas, please feel free to come and start a discussion or join a discussion in the networking discuss group in the Open Solaris communities. Stack instances or IP instances. Here I'm going to walk through what the project goals for this were, a brief overview of zones networking, what it means to have a shared stack versus an exclusive stack, and the delegation of control that came with this project. The original goal for the IP instances project was to provide a more robust architecture for zones networking. What does this mean? This means that we needed to look at ways to provide a more machine-oriented look and feel for networking within a zone, not just a view. Some of the requirements here were to provide per zone routing tables and per zone ARP tables. So when we started putting all of these requirements together, where we ended up is that what each zone needed to have was its own instance of IP. So zone A and zone B could have their own complete TCP/IP stack distinct from the global zones. Who here doesn't know about zones? Cool. Okay, so this is zones networking today. We have applications running in the global zone, zone A and zone B, and they all talk to a single instance of TCP/IP. Now, on the other side of TCP/IP, we have network interfaces. Now, if zone A wants to talk to zone B, it just pretends to send a packet out, and through a collection of function calls inside TCP/IP, the right things get made to happen. Importantly, there's no idea that a network interface is actually reserved for a particular zone. So what does it mean to have a shared stack versus an exclusive stack for IP? In Solaris today, we have what we term a shared IP stack, where we have a global routing table that is seen by all of the zones. The actual view that any particular zone gets of the routing table is only controlled by the logical network interface that has been assigned to it. So if I have six network interfaces in my global zone and I have two logical interfaces in my local zone, the local zone sees the routing table of the global zone as it applies to those two logical network interfaces. Now, you can't change or add any special routes inside the local zone. Everything needs to be managed from the global zone. So if a local zone wants a new network interface, it requires the global zone route to plumb it in or configure it in. Similarly, if the local zone has any specific requirements in terms of TCP/IP performance tuning, all of that needs to happen through the global zone. And what's more, a change made for the benefit of one zone will impact all of the other zones, whether it is of a benefit or not. In a shared stack environment, traffic between zones undergoes what we call shortcut routing, where we say the destination is local to the machine, we'll just deliver it via function calls inside IP rather than sending it out to a network device driver. And another important gotcha with the shared stack arrangement is that packet filtering is only applied to the entire machine. Prior to the packet filtering hooks project, you couldn't do any filtering between zones. But still, as with everything else in the shared stack arrangement, packet filtering is all managed from the global zone. If we look at the way IP is with an exclusive instance, what we've done is we've enabled each zone to have its own routing table and to be able to manage its own routing table. So now if a zone wants to have a different default route out of the machine to the global zone, this is now possible. And it's possible without, it won't have any impact on the ability of the global zone to route packets the way it wishes to. With exclusive IP instances, each zone is able to tweak TCP, etc., in the way that it needs to for its applications to perform the best. This allows us to create zones which are dedicated to specific applications, and having them work with network settings that are tuned for them, rather than needing to find TCP settings which work well for every application that works on the machine. With exclusive IP instances, it's up to each zone to decide what packet filtering it wants or doesn't want. Managing IP filter and IP NAT is now no longer a property of the zone itself. A problem for the global zone. The management of IP filter is up to the local zone itself. And this is part of what we call a delegation of control for zones networking, where an exclusive instance of IP can now no longer be managed from the global zone. It's not just the IP filter that's managed from within the local zone, but the network address of the zone for the zone can also be managed from there. If root in a local zone wishes to use DHCP or tune IP, this is possible. This all comes with the full delegation of control of IP through to the local zone. Now, in doing this, there's one important thing here for global zone users to understand, and that is that ifconfig-a will no longer show you all the network interfaces plumbed on a machine. Ifconfig-a will only show the interfaces in use in the global zone. If your local zone has interfaces assigned to it and it's been set up for exclusive use, then you need to do an ifconfig minus a in the local zone to see those. To allow us to give the zone root user the ability to make all these changes without giving away the house, sorry, giving away the farm, we've split up the sysnet config privilege and introduced a new one called sysip config, so that rather than needing the ability to do wholesale network configuration within a zone, the privilege restriction has been limited to just IP. Inside a zone, a root user can use Snoop on his network interface. This is, I suppose, good and bad. If you didn't trust the root user before and you've given them an exclusive IP instance, this may be of concern for you. On the other hand, it allows better observability for people using networking from within a zone to see what's happening on their network interface. In contrast to nearly everything else to do with networking and zones, you can still use Snoop from the global zone on an interface that's been exclusively assigned to a local zone. So even though you can't use ifconfig on HME0 if it's inside a zone for exclusive use, you can still do Snoop on HME0. Now, there's a minor security threat here, and that is that Zone is now able to forge Ethernet packets. This was a necessary giveaway in order to enable DHCP within a zone. Okay, looking at some of the details of the implementation of IP instances, the big change here is that there's no more global data in IP. So all of the global or private data structures that were in .c files are now in one great big data structure. And every time that we create a new instance of IP, we allocate a new one of these data structures and initialize it appropriately. Each instance of IP is tied to one zone and one zone only at the moment. It's not possible to have more than one instance of IP per zone. A zone either has exclusive IP instance or a shared IP instance. You can't have both, and you can't have more than one. In addition, you can't have an instance of IP without a zone. So you can't run Oracle in the global zone with its own private instance of IP. It has to be running within the context of a zone in order to have its own instance of IP. Now, the only way that you can create or cause a new IP instance to come into being is a new configuration option with zone CFG, and we do a set IP type equals exclusive to enable exclusive IP instances. And similarly, if you wanted to be verbose and say I want to use shared instances, you'd say set IP type equals shared. For more information about the IP instances, you can find it on the Open Solaris website. as part of the Crossbow project. Okay, this is what zones networking looks like with IP instances. We have Zone B has its own private instance of TCP/IP, and NIC2 is dedicated to that zone. NIC2 can't be used by either the global zone or zone A. And with Zone A and global, in the global zone, you have the traditional shared networking view. Now, an important part of this is that if Zone B wants to communicate with Zone A or the global zone, packets need to go out NIC2. And then go out NIC2 and somehow get sent back in NIC1. Yes?
One short question. Did you say that you can still snap the traffic going on the second NIC?
You can.
From the global zone?
Yes.
How does this happen? I think it's important.
And sorry, for your question, you can have a hat.
I've got one already.
Oh, okay. Okay. The level at which Snoop works is DLPI, and it accesses the devices at a layer below IP. What we're doing, within Solaris, what we're saying is that each network interface can only be bound to a SAP once. So, for example, in this case, the SAP is IP. You're aware of what the SAP is in terms of DLPI? Okay. Let me think. A network device driver can provide access to a type of packet. For example, IP is one type of packet, IPv6, Apple Talk, and these are all governed by the type field in the Ethernet header. Now, the type field in the Ethernet header corresponds to, I think it's called a service access point, or SAP, at the networking layer. Right. We allow each NIC to be bound to a particular SAP once. And once it's once we say that it's going to be used in a particular zone, and on top of that, when we configure a network, when we're configuring zones, we say which zone is going to be used for. Now, if we say NIC2 is going to be bound, also used by Zone B, then somebody from Zone A or the global zone can't come along and say, I want to use it in my zone. That's not allowed. Does that answer your
question? It's quite okay.
Okay.
Just one maybe addition. So if IP is config, if config is patched to hide those interfaces,
if config hasn't been patched to hide them, they're just not listed in the global zone or zone A.
Just come to the machine and snoop the interface if it's not visible in the...
Okay, if you want to see which interfaces are visible, then you need to use DLADM and show dev or show link. Yep.
It has to be shared always with the global zone, or can two local zones share one instance?
Local zones can't share the same IP instance. So a local zone either has to share the global zone's instance of IP or have its own private one. This is another diagram of where we're going with this, if you're using IP instances and VLANs, where we've got a BGE interface with VLANs 1000 or 10001 and 33001. We have, even though we've got one physical network interface, at the Solaris level, we convert them into three different network interfaces. And each one can be taken up separately into IP and given to zones. Any questions? No. Okay. Next, I'd like to talk about Crossbow. I'm just going to do a little bit of a background on Crossbow and the Fire Engine project for people who aren't quite familiar with what SQs are, and then talk about what we're achieving with the Crossbow project in terms of bandwidth control and VNix. Coming into Solaris 10, there was a project called Fire Engine, and the goal of the Fire Engine project was to make Solaris's TCP/IP stack perform more competitively with respect to Linux and the current Windows TCP/IP stack. Some of the things that we did to achieve this were merging TCP and IP from being separate streams modules to being joined together. In doing this, there was some code refactoring to take advantage of reduced code paths. For example, there was no longer any need for IP to be using put next to send packets, or sorry, to send data into TCP. Things like that disappeared, and they just became function calls directly into IP and TCP. There are two pre-existing interfaces that we needed to preserve. DevIP and DevTCP had been available in the past, and if you open them today, although they're just managed by the same module, opening the respective one gets you behavior of the TCP module prior to Solaris 10 or the IP module prior to Solaris 10. The entry points for those for opening those devices guarantees you the correct behavior. In the merging of IP and TCP, we've been able to reduce the level of context switching that we do, and in addition, increase the caches that we see in the second and first level caches. Fire Engine project provided the first implementation of SQs, or serialization queues. SQs provide what we call a vertical perimeter with Solaris networking. So what is an SQ? The SQ is a serialization queue, which is a first-in, first-out implementation. An SQ provides functions on a per CPU basis for all input, for all packets going in and out of it. So that if you have an SQ on BGA0 and that gets assigned to CPU1 in a multi-CPU machine, then all packets going in and out of that network interface are processed by CPU1. Ideally they are never processed by any other CPU. The SQ provides mutual exclusion to TCP without locks. How did we achieve this? The serialization queue is that one packet moves through the stack at a time. So we take a packet or a collection of packets off the network interface, they go into IP, then they go into TCP. Now, because these packets are all part of the same connection, or IP address, or what have you, we bind a network interface to a particular CPU, we never have to worry about another CPU interrupting our current processing and potentially stomping on our data at the same time as we are. So that at any particular time, there is at most one thread working on an execute. So from top to bottom of the networking stack, we have, packets keep the same CPU. Now the relationship between SQs and CONTs and CPUs is roughly as presented below. You can have any number of connections or CONTs associated with an SQ, but each CONT can only belong to one SQ, but SQ can have any number of connections on it. As to an SQ can only belong to one CPU at a time, but any CPU can be responsible for any number of SQs. Did that go down okay? Okay. Crossbow. What is Crossbow? Crossbow provides the building blocks for network virtualization and resource control by creating virtual stacks around any service, protocol, or virtual machines like containers, Xen, and LDOMs. So with this, I'm going to look at what we're doing in terms of bandwidth control and virtual network interfaces. So the goals of Crossbow's bandwidth control are to be able to manage and share bandwidth on a network interface card. What we'd like to be able to do is say, I want to reserve X megabytes a second for this particular purpose, or say this service can use at most Y megabits a second. To achieve some of the technology we've implemented to do this are different types of packet dropping, such as RED, traffic shaping, as well as different queuing disciplines. Crossbow's virtual network interfaces each have their own virtual resources. So for example, transmit and receive descriptor rings, DMA channels, MAC addresses, kernel threads and queues. So where possible, these virtual resources are backed by the actual resources in the hardware. So if a network interface and hardware supports, say, 16 different descriptor rings and multiple, then Crossbow will try and use those available in the hardware to satisfy requirements of virtual network interfaces before implementing soft descriptor rings in software. Now we do the same for DMA channels. For MAC addresses, if we require too many MAC addresses for the network interface to support, then we're forced to push the network interface card into promiscuous mode. Virtual network interfaces can only be defined above NeMo networking devices. Now, what does that mean? It means that it works above things such as BGEs, aggregations, XGEs, NGEs, but isn't likely to work above your QFEs, HMEs, or LEs. The reason being is that the older network device drivers haven't been ported to NeMo and aren't likely to be in the near future. So what do we do with these virtual network interfaces? What they allow us to do is to carve up high-speed network interfaces into multiple virtual network interfaces. So we can say I've got a 10 gigabit a second network interface. I can create 10 1 gigabit per second virtual network interfaces by saying each one of these 10 network interfaces can use at most 1 gigabit per second on this card. This is where the bandwidth control quota restrictions come into play. The virtual network interfaces have been implemented as an EMO device or a GLD V3 MAC driver, so we can do aggregations, etc., over them. You can assign hardware resources to them, such as interrupts, descriptor rings, etc. Now, where possible, what we're trying to do is use hardware-based flow control to deliver packets into VNICs for the best performance. So if we're defining virtual network interface for HTTP, so we say I want all packets with port 80 in them to come in on VNIC 1. Now, if I can look at the hardware and say, does the hardware support delivering packets into descriptor rings based on the destination port address? Now, if that's possible, the classification of the packet between the normal descriptor ring and the VNIC 1 descriptor ring is pushed down into the network interface, so that we're taking this load off Solaris. An important aspect of this is that we can assign VNICs to zones or Zen domains. So if we couple this up with the IP instances project, we don't need to use VLAN tagging in order to get multiple physical interfaces for exclusive use in zones. I can take my BG0 and create VNIC 1 and VNIC 2 on top of that and assign VNIC 1 and VNIC 2 exclusively into zones. Okay, this diagram gives us an idea, shows how we associate SQs with services and virtual network interfaces. So here we have each SQ is associated with a descriptor ring, so that all of our HTTP packets have their own SQ and are fed up through VNIC 1. Now we can create individual descriptor rings for particular types of traffic. If we're looking to try and guarantee particular types of network performance for an application. For example, if we want give priority to the HTTP traffic, then we create a specific descriptor ring for that and use Crossbow to configure it in that way. Okay, the Crossbow project is featured on the Open Solaris website and has its own mailing list, so that if you're interested in further details, you can join in there. Okay, last but not least, I'm going to look at NeMo. What is NeMo? NeMo is a network device driver interface. It's for people who are writing network device drivers. It's targeted at making interrupt handling easier, and it also provides trunking. NeMo is also known as GLD V3. GLD standing for Generic LAN Driver. This was first introduced in Solaris 7. It was bumped up to version 2 in Solaris 9, and with Open Solaris today, we currently have GLD version 3. The drivers that are currently supporting GLD version 3 are BGE, NGE, XGE, RGE, IXGB, E1000G. It's a high-performance framework that IP can use to control all activities and resources without burdening the device driver. We do this by requiring, by providing a collection of interfaces that, within the NeMo framework that IP can use and then further control the devices as it sees fit. Unfortunately, even though it's version 3, it's not quite finished as yet. Although work is currently in progress to make the IP more robust and future-proof. The GLD framework defines programming interfaces that are provided by Solaris. For example, when a network device driver receives a packet, it's expected to call a function called MACRX. And MACRX handles delivering that packet further up into IP or whatever else might be above the network device driver. The NeMo interface also defines which interfaces a driver must supply. For example, network device drivers are required to implement a transmit function, which is called by NeMo when it wants to send out a packet over the network. One of the more recent advances in the NeMo framework has been the provision of a MAC-type plugin framework, where there are specific types of network are registered, Ethernet, IP tunnel, and Wi-Fi, to name a few that exist today. These provide a generic framework for common functionality where, for example, picking up the MAC address, etc. What does NeMo do for interrupt moderation? NeMo network interrupt moderation. In the early days, network interrupts caused by networking cards were the better way to driver I/O. But now we've come to a point where we've got extremely high packet rates, and we can have interrupts generated by networking cards overwhelming the operating system and making it hard for the operating system to function normally. With a large number of interrupts come a large number of context switches and extra overhead. There are a whole lot of things now with 1 gig and 10 gig network cards which make interrupt-driven networking not quite as good as what it was originally. The NeMo interrupt moderation allows us to bind a NIC to an SQ and then for the SQ to control the behavior of the NIC by turning on and off interrupts. So that if an SQ thinks that it's becoming backlogged and it's got too many packets and it can't process them, or too many interrupts, then the SQ is able to turn off interrupts for a period of time. Now the idea here has been that if we turn off the interrupts, then the CPU has more bandwidth to process packets and clear out some of its backlog. And once the SQ gets back to normal, it's then enabled to re-enable interrupt processing on a network interface. While a network interface has interrupts disabled, it's if it's able to receive packets still, it can send them up later as a chain of packets. So what do we get in terms of performance out of interrupt moderation? It varies, but in usual web workloads, we can see a 20% performance improvement. So if we look at MP stat output from two different drivers, one being a GLDV3-based driver versus an older driver, we can immediately see that there is a large reduction in the number of interrupts that are happening, large reduction in the number of context switches, and related behaviour associated with those. So what does all this mean in terms of performance? Well, we end up with less system time being spent processing packets and more idle time. So we've got not only better performance, but the machine has become more available to do other tasks besides handling packets. NeMo trunking is achieved using AGGR devices, and sits above either 1 gig or 10 gigabyte NICs. For those who are using this, in terms of specifications, it implements 802.3 AD as well as LACP. Each member of the trunk has its own individual SQ, so that different halves or different parts of a trunk can manage the flow of packets in and out depending upon the workload. Now, the trunking doesn't depend upon any specific support in the device driver. Any old device driver that does GLDV3 will do. And through NeMo, we're able to achieve close to linear scalability with 4 1-gigabyte NICs. I think we're looking at about 3.6 gigabits a second over 4 bonded channels. And the end. Questions? Yes? You have to have a hat.
Imagine three... Oh!
Damn it!
3 zones with all the IP instances that you see.
Mm-hmm.
Can zone B forward packets to A and C?
Sorry, can...
Can zone B forward packets between the other zones?
Not yet. There are... We're looking at projects to implement virtual networking inside Solaris. And that will be... what we need to construct are virtual wires between Zone B and Zone C and Zone A. And we can't yet do that.
Okay.
Yes?
Can you somehow compare the number or the structure or something about the hooks in the new filtering API?
Sorry,
can you compare the number of hooks in the stack in Solaris in the new API compared to NetFilter hooks?
Linux supports pre-routing, post-routing, forwarding, local in, local out. Solaris supports physical in, physical out, forwarding, loop back in, and loop back out. On Linux, loop back in and loop back out are combined with, I believe, local in and local out. I think Solaris is missing the equivalence of local in and local out But then Linux doesn't provide the separation that Solaris does with respect to loopback traffic.
Mm-hmm. Both interfaces are equivalent.
Correct.
Maybe a related question, how do you manage to keep the source code compilable still on all of the platforms? I mean, I can imagine the APIs are different for different types of kernels in NetBSD, BSD.
This is an IP filter question. The source code, I suppose, is broken up into the IP filter source code and then the per platform interface. And the per platform interface deals with registering the hooks and getting addresses and sending packets, etc. You can't currently bridge with Solaris.
I don't know, but I've seen a page for 2 months or 3 months, but the page is gone now with Open Solaris. My question is, what happened?
I suppose internally, the networking part of Solaris, has just been reorganized, or the kernel portion of networking has just been reorganized. So we need to reevaluate which projects we're going to be doing and how we're going to approach them. And bridging will be part of that.
Maybe another question. How did you manage to pull back your because I saw some code when you walk through IT lower level instances, and then now you say that it's not supported to access the IPv6 data internally.
I think what I maybe I didn't mention it very well. The packet filtering hooks project, the APIs that we introduced in that replaced all of the APIs we put together in the pfil module. So everything that was providing, we now provide through the APIs from the packet filtering hooks project. Does that answer your question?
My question is, how did you convince people?
Oh, we said we have these requirements in terms of information that we need to get. It was inadvisable to have IP linking directly against, IP filter linking directly against IP, or at least that was my take on it. So we brought in a layer that fits between it so that IP can evolve without impacting IP filter. Not yet. That's a different project called IP Observability.
So it doesn't relate to packet filtering API?
No.
Okay.
Is that all? Oh, yes?
Is it possible now to fake MAC address such a way that from one interface you send
the
Ethernet frames with different
MAC addresses? Yes. You can do that in Solaris or inside a zone with IP instances.
So there is some API by which you can tell this IP packet should be sent using Ethernet frames, using this MAC address, and another IP address would be sent.
I think the interface you would use would be the raw streams DLPI interface, and that allows you to supply the complete packet that you want to send out.
What was the problem with IPsec behind the NUT?
What's the problem with IPsec behind NUT?
Solaris.
You've got the wrong person here. You need someone from the IPsec team.
I'll answer the question.